back to Isaiah 3, where we ran out of time, I think. We'll go back to Isaiah chapter 3 and pick up there. Let's start with a word of prayer. Can I get one of the brothers to lead us in that? Who wants to do that? Nobody's making eye contact. Thank you, Charles.
Father God, we give you thanks, Father, for this day of we're able to worship you, Father, and spread the truth. We thank you now for this time together. We have a class to study under the portion of my word, Father. We thank you for the one leading the class, Father, that brings your word to us, that brings in insights to some of the things that perhaps we've not seen, and gives us good explanations, Father. May we all garner this knowledge and grow from it, Father. And be with all the hearers here and those that are perhaps in another class as well. And we continue to be blessed with the workers that we have in this congregation. I ask you in Jesus Christ's most holy name.
All right, chapter 3, we're going to just read a little bit to get back into it, but in particular in chapter 3, where we were, and I think kind of where we ran out of time, the first part of that chapter, Wednesday night, starting in verse 1 to the beginning of the chapter, part of the point of what's being said here, and of course, part of what I like to underscore is I think there's a sense in which God is certainly talking to his own people, but this is also just how God works. These are the kinds of things that God does. And part of how he runs the world, and part of what's worth thinking about is none of this is miraculous in the sense of, you know, fire from heaven, suspend the laws of nature kind of stuff. This is God just kind of putting his finger on the scale providentially how he runs the world, which means that this, you know, these are tools in God's toolbox even down to today. You don't have to have Elijah, you know, going on Mount Carmel and calling down fire for God to get involved in a nation's affairs. Any nation's affairs, and part of what we forget, jumping ahead a little bit, but fast-forwarding, you know, Isaiah 13, chapters 13 to 23, are a bunch of oracles to the nations. And one of the things that we often forget, I mentioned this from time to time, but one of the things that we often forget, even under the Old Covenant, just because Israel was the only nation with a covenant with God, you know, and the Ten Commandments and all the other things that come with being the people of God, by no means does that mean the rest of the nations and people on earth were excused in their sin. And that's why you have all these, and it's not just Isaiah, across the prophets, oracles against the nations. Why did God send Jonah to Nineveh to tell them that they were about to be destroyed? Because Nineveh was still under God's judgment. Human beings have always been responsible to God for their sin. Every nation stands before God under judgment. And that wasn't just, so it wasn't just an Israel thing. It was, again, the point, and Isaiah is one of the prophets who makes this most clear in terms of Israel's failure. Israel's job was to be a light to the nations so that those who were looking for how to live and what to do before the one true God, maker of heaven and earth, could come and learn. And by the way, that's why Isaiah, importantly, is one of the prophets who says in Isaiah 2, where we always look, in the last days what will happen? The mountain of the house of the Lord will be the place for which all nations come and say, basically, to God, teach us your ways, which we now recognize as the gospel in the church. Good. Hey, Chad, can you grab the door for the baker? Thank you, sir. Thank you. But that was always Israel's point. All right, Corey, you may grab the door for him on the other side. Garland will beat you to it. Anyways. thank you both. But anyways, so one of the things that we forget is, you know, this is just how, you know, God runs the world, period. You know, does God say to Nebuchadnezzar in the book of Daniel, well, you know, since you didn't get the Ten Commandments, you're not accountable to me for your pride? Is that how God approached Nebuchadnezzar? Absolutely not. And so we forget all humanity has always been amenable to God, accountable to God morally. And so, you know, these are tools in God's toolbox, no miracle required, anytime, anyplace. He just happens to be deploying them against his own people who were extra guilty because they, and again, the prophets bring this out to Israel, you really knew. And you agreed to obey me. Remember Mount Sinai and the covenant we made? You agreed to follow this law. And so there's a culpability there that even the nations hadn't run up. Anyways. And so just quickly to get back into a chapter 3, because I think chapters 3, 4, and 5 are particularly powerful and profound. being an overview, big picture concepts that the rest of the book wants to work with. So one thing that happens in chapter 3, especially verses 1 through 15, is part of what God does in his judgment on the people, and again, this is so relevant to the time we live in, is he gives them corrupt and even incompetent leadership. In other words, you don't fall because you get bad leaders. The bad leaders are the mark that you are already under God's judgment for your failure. And so and there's almost some comedy, I think, intentionally so here. Behold, the Lord God of hosts is taking away from Jerusalem, from Judah, support and supply. And the word we'd use today would be infrastructure. You know, both you know, food, but even human capital, as we call it today, with our human resources departments. Supports like all support of bread and all support of water. So you got famine and drought, but also, you know, competent people, the mighty man, the soldier, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, the man of 50, the man of rank, the counselor, the skillful magician, the expert in charms. And in place of competent people, what I'll leave you with is, I will make boys their princes and infants shall rule over them. I remember here recently in the last congressional election, there was a great celebration because the first member of Gen Z was elected. Now, the Gen Z is kind of the youngest generation that's over 18 in our culture right now. Now, no offense to those of you who are younger, but most of human history, we didn't celebrate picking the youngest among us to rule. No offense. And generally, younger people understood you didn't want the burdens of it. Anyways, if you really understood what came with real leadership, that it was an immense responsibility and even burden to be born, which is why men of age and experience traditionally and typically in most sane societies were the ones who got that job. In our culture, we flip it around. We want the old out, and we want the young in with their new ideas and everything. And it's not to say that young people can't make a contribution. Don't misunderstand me. But we're talking about a culture's view of how things ought to be. And God says, actually, a mark of my judgment is boys will be their princes. Infants shall rule over them. And the people will oppress one another, everyone his fellow, everyone his neighbor. The youth will be insolent, arrogant to the elder, and the despised to the honorable. And so it gets so bad that a man will take hold of his brother in the house of his father saying, hey, you have a cloak. You should be our leader. You know what? You still got a suit. That looks like the part of being a leader. You should be the leader. We'll just go by who's got the best clothes. It's almost as bad as our celebrity culture has gotten, hasn't it? I remember years ago, Amanda took a class when she was getting her degree on nonverbal psychology. And she came back, you know, gave us a lot to talk about, including how I crossed my legs at her. But, don't cross your legs in that tone, voice. But no, anyways, but beyond that, you know, one thing that's happened in the television age, presidential elections, with only one or two exceptions, you realize that the taller candidate wins. Doesn't really matter the party. That's how shallow we are. Whoever looks best on television has the advantage with a couple of exceptions. We are that kind of people. I have an essay that I make the interns read just to understand, because again, the culture seeps into the church. I make the interns read, in which this writer, this social observer and historian, makes a point about how in U.S. culture we used to be about character, now we're about personality. We pick the candidate who's most relatable to me. Either that means I get an adulterer and scoundrel and corrupt person in office, but he feels my pain, or he looks like me, or he comes from my side. You know, but the bottom line is, we don't pick on character, we pick on personality. And so we get what we deserve sometimes. So a man will take hold of his brother in the house of his father, saying, you have a cloak, you should be our leader, and this heap of ruin shall be under your rule. And in a sense, again, not even realizing how you're squabbling over the ruins of a society, but that's what it is. But in that day, he will speak on saying, I will not be a healer. In my house, there is neither bread nor cloak. You shall not make me leader of this people. I don't have any solutions. I wish our publishers would be that honest sometimes. I just know how to make it worse. For Jerusalem has stumbled, Judah has fallen, because their speech and their deeds are against the Lord, defying his glorious presence. And that language of glory is important, because in chapter 6 we're going to see that language of glory show up when Isaiah sees God. For the look on their faces bears witness against them. They proclaim their sin like Sodom. They do not hide it. As I mentioned, we call that Pride Month now. We literally parade our debaucheries and celebrate them. We have flags to celebrate it. Sometimes those flags are flown as high or even given preference over the national flag. We truly declare our sin like Sodom. Tell the righteous in the midst of this, though, verse 10, that it shall be well with them. They shall eat the fruit of their deeds. It's easy in such a culture for the righteous remnant to get discouraged. And God's word through Isaiah then and now is, if you're discouraged by, you know, what you see going on in the workplace, in schools, in the culture, in politics, as you watch a decadent society under God's judgment more and more becoming obvious, don't get discouraged, because you will eat the fruit of your deeds too. God sees and God knows. Tell the righteous it shall be well with them. Woe to the wicked, it shall be ill with him, for what his hands have dealt out shall be done to him. And then you hear God's kind of, you know, sadness here. My people, infants are their oppressors, and women rule over them. That's how weak you've become. Oh, my people, your guides mislead you, and they have swallowed up the course of your paths. The Lord has taken his place to contend. He stands to judge peoples. The Lord will enter into judgment. And notice he judges the leadership at the end of the day. Because at the end of the day, people are sheep. It's an apt analogy. Not, again, the Bible kind of presents both sides. Every individual is accountable. Every individual has moral agency. In a victimhood culture, we need to get past the fact that, yes, people have circumstances, sometimes challenging circumstances, but that never removes moral agency. You know, Manasseh had Josiah had Manasseh for a father, and yet he is one of the highest praised kings in the Bible. By the same token, Manasseh, you know, was related to Hezekiah, another good king, and yet look at what he chose to become. Everybody makes choices no matter what the obstacles we have. In our culture, we're more and more denying that. We talk about, you know, systemic this and whatever. And it's not to say that those things don't exist, because the Bible, I think, affirms that, you know, culture has a weight, the family has a weight. And yet, at the same time, the Bible affirms that every last person gets to make his or her own choice. Both can be true. And are true biblically. One of the great marks, by the way, of human heresy, religious or cultural, is not that it's completely wrong. There's always an element of truth. That's why we fall in it. There's a kernel or an element of truth in most heresy. The problem is what it leaves out, what it fails to affirm, what it fails to acknowledge. Do our families, our cultures, our cities have a role in the hand that we are dealt in life? Of course they do. That can be true without denying the fact that you still get to make a choice. But because of the weight of a culture, a society, a family, that's why the Lord's judgment starts with the elders and the princes of his people. Jesus' version of this in the Gospels is, woe to stumbling blocks. Woe to those who make it harder for everybody else to be what they're supposed to be. And so the Lord takes his place to contend as he judges people, and he enters into judgment, first of all, with the leadership, with the elders and priests who have presided over the disaster. It is you who have devoured the vineyard, the spoil of the poor in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people, by grinding the face of the poor, declares the Lord of hosts. And you see this in Jesus' own work, right? Who does Jesus go after most vividly? He goes after religious leadership. He goes after Pharisees. He goes after Sadducees. He goes after the chief priests and the high priests. The text will talk about he looks at the multitude and has compassion on them as sheep without a shepherd. Because the leadership class among the Jews had failed. He saw them as victims, culpable victims, because the multitudes themselves eventually came to reject him too, because he wasn't giving out free lunch all the time. And he actually called them to service and sacrifice. But nonetheless, had they been victimized by their leadership class? Absolutely. Yes, sir?
You bring up a great example, but it's the perception of power that's being addressed both here in Isaiah and in Jesus. Mm-hmm. It's we as a people, we perceive power, but we need to be reminded where lies the real power and not be caught up in the false perception of power / authority.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. All right, chapter 3, verse 16. We switch gears a little bit now. Social decadence. And the Lord said, Because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with outstretched necks and glance wantonly with their eyes, mincing along as they go, tinkling with their feet. Therefore the Lord will strike with a scab the heads of the daughters of Zion, and the Lord will lay bare their secret parts. And in that day the Lord will take away the finery of the anklets, the headbands, the crescents, the pendants, the bracelets, the scarves, the headdresses, the armlets, the sashes, the perfume boxes, the amulets, the signet rings, the nose rings, my goodness. The festal robes, the mantles, the cloaks. What's the point of that exhaustive of a list? I mean, we're kind of getting worn down there. Excess? What else could we say? That's certainly part of it. Excess. You know, we thought they were so poor back then.
External.
Material.
Vanity.
Vanity, pride in that. Why is he poking at women here?
He already did the men's side of what they were not doing correctly.
Yeah. Absolutely. And because especially the leadership class, generally speaking, is going to be male. And God, again, part of his point is my judgment on you. We talked about this Wednesday night. Part of my judgment is, you know, I'll leave you with the women in charge instead, which, going back to the book of Judges with Deborah and Barak, that was, again, God's way of saying men have failed in the role I gave them when I have to raise women up to do it instead. Yes, ma'am, Sister Royalty.
Part of this is that you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
You're fooling with the hair, the clothing, have you visited those that need help?
Yeah.
Have you helped someone who needs help?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that's part of it. You think about even New Testament admonitions in both Paul and Peter about this, right? You know, 1 Peter, when Paul talks about, in 1 Timothy, when Paul talks about, there we go, I'll get that straight. In 1 Timothy, when Paul talks about, women modesty is not the plaiting of the hair and the overdressing, but, you know, the quiet and gentle spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. And by the same token, and later in 1 Timothy in chapter 5, it talks about widows, you know, aged women, when you get to the end of their life, you know, what should it look like? And the widows who were worthy of the church's support are those who did exactly the types of things that Sister Royalty just mentioned, because that's the mark of the virtuous women. And along the same line, you know, Peter talks about, again, you know, the woman who is submissive to her husband without fear. I mean, you know, as opposed to, this is the shallow, silly woman. And part of it is, let me say this, I'll let Vicky weigh in here. Part of it is this, too. I mean, I think part of it is what we've already mentioned. We've gone to leadership class, which is primarily going to be men, and now we come to the silly, vain, shallowness of the women. They're all a mess. They're all a train wreck. But part of it is this, too. In a lot of cases in the Bible, how often do men fall for unvirtuous women? As right? What does King Lemuel's mother say to him in the book of Proverbs? Do not give your strength to women. What's he getting at? This kind of woman manipulates and brings down a lot of men, right? This is a type of woman who, you know, lays, corrupts men. Men corrupt women. Women corrupt men. It's a vicious cycle. Everybody does it. But it's worth noticing that in a decadent society, you know, the vogue woman is the ideal. Yes, ma'am.
Well, and he's already said that he's made fun of people, as you did, electing or calling as leaders those who have a nice suit left.
Yeah. Yeah.
So God is not looking at all of the trappings on the outside.
Yeah.
He's looking at what's on the inside.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so he's saying, you know, you can wear all these things,
yep,
but that is not who you should be.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so he inverts it, verse 24. Instead of perfume, there's going to be rottenness. You know, the stench of your sickness, your decay, cannot be covered up with perfume. Instead of a belt, a rope. Instead of well-set hair, baldness. Instead of a rich robe, a skirt of sackcloth. Branding instead of beauty. And your young men shall fall by the sword, your mighty men in battle, and her gates shall lament and mourn empty. She shall sit on the ground, chapter breaks in the wrong place, and seven women shall take hold of one man in that day. This is part of the end of this description he's giving. And seven women will take hold of one man in that. So all this, you know, beauty, false beauty and flirtatiousness and externalized sexuality and fomenting of this kind of shallow world. Instead, when the judgment of God falls, you'll have seven women chasing one man that they saying, "We will eat our own bread and wear our own clothes. Only let us be called by your name. Take away our reproach. Where have all the good men gone?" Well, they'll be dead from the invasions. But even today, you know, there's a crisis of, you know, good men to go around. And I say this in all seriousness as the father of three daughters and one son. I'm far more worried about three good young men for my daughters than my son being able to find a good woman. Because in every society, good men have always been in short supply. And so these silly, shallow women, when the judgment falls, and of course, part of why there's going to be shortage of men is not just, you know, they're all in mom's basement playing video games now. They're going to be dead. They're going to be dead because of the carnage. But the bottom line is the same. And so seven women chasing one man. And understand what they're saying. What they're saying is basically, you know, because, you know, for most of human history, they were single income families. And so the man's job, if he took a wife, was to support her. What she's basically saying is, I'll feed myself. I won't add anything to the expense, you know, what you've got to provide for. Just take away the reproach of being an unmarried woman. Let me have your name. Marry me. Seven women to one man. That's the idea. And again, it's not that, you know, singleness is wrong, but for most of human history, people want to get married. And, you know, in an ancient society, you know, and maybe we should recover more of this because we abort our babies in our society, but for most of human history, women wanted to be mothers. We didn't, you know, we didn't avoid it at all costs and call it health care. Women wanted it. And so, you know, the reproach of being, you know, a woman without a man, no husband, no father, no brother. You just didn't want that in most human societies until feminism got a hold of us, you know, a couple hundred years ago, starting with Mary Wollstonecraft's, among others, famous book in the 1700s. Anyways, so that's what it comes down to. Eventually, the regret. But there's a window of hope here. Chapter 4, verse 2 is really where chapter 4 should start. In a window of hope, a glimpse of hope. But in that day, as catastrophic as it is, society crumbles. Marriage is crumbling, if nothing else, just because there's not enough men left to go around. So we've got this complete collapse of society through chapter 3. But in that day, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land shall be the pride and the honor of the survivors of Israel. And he who is left in Zion, this righteous remnant that God's people that lasts through judgment. Remember what did he say in chapter 3? Tell the righteous, it will be well for you. You will eat the fruit of your faithfulness. And so when that day comes, he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. Everyone who has been recorded for life in Jerusalem. Your name's on the list of the ultimate exclusive club. You walk up to the gates and the bouncer says, I know you. You're on the list. You belong in this place, in this city. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, cleansed the bloodstains of Jerusalem from its mist by a spirit of judgment and a spirit of burning. God's fiery judgment does one of two things. It destroys that which is evil, which is substantive, or which is substanceless. I can't say that. Substanceless. But it purifies that which is true and real. And so the wicked substancelessness and those who live and are defined by it are burned away. And his people are now holy. They have been purified. But they both have to go through the same events. That's the hard truth. But you know what they say? Hard times make for strong men. Easy times make for weak men. Weak men make for hard times. You know, so on and so forth. Then the Lord will create over the whole site of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day and the smoke and a shining flame of fire by night. That ring a bell? You've seen that before somewhere? Yeah, what's that a mark of? Yeah, he's back. He's back. For over all the glory there will be a canopy, and there will be a booth for shade by day from the heat, and for a refuge and a shelter from the storm and the rain. All right, so this image of hope ends this ugly picture of a complete collapse of a society. Tell the righteous. And again, that's part of what the people of God need to understand. You know, don't stick your head in the sand, you know, when it comes to reading the news. Yeah, it's bad out there. But the point is, you're living for something that comes after the collapse and after the judgment. That's, we don't deny it, and we don't avoid it. What God's people do is they go through it with hope and faithfulness. That's what God's people do. All right, so we begin to wrap up the opening of the book in week three. two things going on here in chapter 7. The first thing going on in this verse is 1 through 7. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 7.
Thank you.
Whatever I said, whatever I didn't say, I know what I meant. Nobody else does. But chapter 5, 1 through 7 is a song, and an important song in terms of the larger, all the Bible, actually. Well, let's read it first, and then let's tie some lines from before and after. Let me sing a song for my beloved, my song, my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. And he dug it, and he cleared the stones, and he planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it. He hewed out a wine vat in it. That's on-site processing for those of you who do business with the business school and know about vertical integration. Built a watchtower in the midst of it, hewed out a wine vat in it. He looked for it to yield grapes. Why? Because he's built this perfectly designed, perfectly integrated place for grapes and wine. And he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded instead wild grapes. All right. The concept there is just simply, there's a reason that even in ancient times, you cultivated certain plants over others because the cultivated ones tasted better or were healthier. And so one of the things that actually absolutely happened in the ancient world, and he says even the book of Ezekiel, grapes in particular, they had cultivated grapes that were good. You know, they weren't stupid. They understood about breeding and all that with animals. I mean, remember, Jacob, back 4,000 years ago, knows how to hose Laban with some breeding on his animals. I mean, they weren't stupid. We really give the ancients credit. And so they knew about horticulture too. And so you had the kind of grapes you want. They're going to give you a good, something good to eat and good wine out of it. Or, the stuff that grows in the wild. And he gets wild grapes. Remember the book of Ezekiel, the proverb that goes, the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set up. Because they understood, some of that stuff that grows out there in the wild, it's not good. So he's basically intentionally started this vineyard with choice. What is it? Verse 2, planted it with choice vines. He's very intentional about everything about this. And he's done everything possible. Planted it on a very fertile hill, verse 1. He's done everything possible to produce good fruit. But instead, what does he get? Sour or wild grapes. And maybe for us to get the better point, sour grapes instead. Verse 3, now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. I want you to think about this and answer my question. Here's the question, verse 4. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield sour grapes instead? Why is he asking the people of Israel? Anybody got the point of the parable yet? You are the vineyard. I did everything on my side to equip you and empower you to produce good fruit. And so if the vineyard is not producing good fruit, is it on me or is it on the vineyard? It's on the vineyard. So the rhetorical question of verse 4. So verse 5, now I will tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge and it shall be devoured. That's when you give up on your garden and you quit weeding it. That's what he basically says. I'm not going to protect it. I'm not going to make it special and glorious and paradisical anymore. I'm not going to weed the garden anymore. I'm not going to, when wild animals want to come in and graze, when cross-pollination happens, I'm not going to do anything to make this special anymore. I will remove its hedge and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall and it shall be trampled. Again, presumably by wild animals now, right? I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed. Rather, briars and thorns shall grow up. I will also command the clouds, and so they will not rain upon it. So it will also just kind of drought. It will wither up and die. Look like your yard after this summer. The vineyard of the Lord of hosts, just in case you missed the point now, Isaiah, and God will make it explicit for those who are a little bit hard-hearted or hard-headed. The vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. And what fruit did he look for? He looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. And for righteousness, but behold, an outcry. And part of the driving home of this is in Hebrew, there's a word play here, because the words for justice and bloodshed sound alike in Hebrew, and the words for righteousness and outcry sound alike in Hebrew. He's punning. He's punning off, you know, to drive home the point. And make it a very vivid example in their hearing. And so this powerful parable of the vineyard. But the fact of the matter is that the vineyard, you know, metaphor, the idea that Israel is God's planting, first of all, goes all the way back, you know, to Moses in Exodus. You go all the way back to Exodus 15. The image of Israel as a planter of vineyards, a powerful one. Exodus chapter 15, let's see, I'm in the Song of Moses here. At the very end of it, you know, here, the end of the Song of Moses, the song of Moses and the people of Israel sang there. This is at the parting of the sea, when God delivers them, the great miracle of the Old Testament. He says, verse 17, you will bring them in and plant them on your own mountain. The place, O Lord, which you have made for your abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. And so they were going to be a special planting in a special place. If we had more times, we'd chase this around a little bit. It shows up in the Psalms. This idea shows up in Jeremiah. But for our purposes, two places in the New Testament where this idea of Israel as a special planting, and even more so, a special vineyard, show up. Book of Matthew chapter 21. This is literally after the triumphal entry. So these are literally Jesus' final days. Matthew chapter 21. And so he's in the temple, and I'm going to pick up, let's see, I want to pick up in verse, I want to pick up in verse 33. Matthew 21, verse 33. Hear another parable. So keep going. This is just a few days before they killed Jesus. This is part of where Jesus said some things that pushed them over the edge even more, you know, than they're already upset with him. And so he says, hear another parable. There was a master of a house who planted a vineyard and put a fence around it and dug a wine press in it and built a tower. Wait, does that sound really familiar? That sounds exactly like what we just read in Isaiah 5, right? Listen. You're saying this in the temple area. You're saying this in Jerusalem. You think those priests and those scribes and those lawyers don't know their Isaiah? You think they don't hear the echo of what he's up to? So there was a master of a house who planted this vineyard. Verse 34, when the season for fruit drew near, he sent his servants and attendants to get his fruit. And the tenants took his servants, beat one, killed another, stoned another. And he sent other servants, more to the first. They did the same to them. Finally, he sent his son, saying, they will respect my son. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to themselves, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him and have his inheritance. And so they took him, they threw him out of the vineyard, and they killed him. Okay, so Jesus adapts the image a little bit now, because who are the tenants of the vineyard? Who's responsible for the vineyard? Isaiah didn't go down this road, but having even read what we just read in Isaiah 3. Well, the prophets and priests are the ones who are sent, but who are the tenants that the prophets and priests are sent to?
The Jews?
Well, the leaders. The leaders of the people. They're the tenants who are responsible for maintaining the vineyard in the absence of the master, right? The master gave the, you know, creates it, and he gives the law, he gives the instructions, and he goes away, and he leaves tenants, subleasers in charge. That's the Jewish leadership. And like we saw in Isaiah 3, God has for generations been unhappy with Jewish leadership. And so yes, now the ones that he says are the priests, or I'm sorry, the prophets and those whom they kill, culminating in
Jesus himself.
Yeah.
But priests are going to be in this list as tenants.
Yes, correct. They're on the wrong side of this list now. They should have been. they should have been, you know, keepers of knowledge and law. Instead, they're part of the problem. They're part of the tenets. And so the prophets come and rebuke the true prophets, you know, guys like Isaiah and Ezekiel, Hosea, Amos, and so on and so forth. They come and they speak. What happens to prophets? They're often killed. I'll send my son. They'll listen to him. They send Jesus. What's about to happen? In about 5 days from when he speaks this, they're going to kill him. And so, but notice how Jesus finishes the parable. When verse 40, after they kill the son, verse 40, therefore the owner of the vineyard comes. What will he do to those tenants? And they said, he will, and his audience says, he will put those wretches to miserable death and let out the vineyard to other tenants who will give him the fruits in their seasons. And so Jesus said to them, have you never read in the scriptures that the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone? And this was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore, I tell you, the kingdom will be taken away from you and given to a people producing its fruits. And the one who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, and when it falls on anyone, it will crush him. And when the chief priests and the Pharisees heard this parable, they perceived that he was speaking about... He took Isaiah's parable and he made it personal. I'm talking about you. And although they were seeking to arrest him, they feared the crowds because they held him to be a prophet. Kind of ironic. Why were they so angry at Jesus for this parable?
It's a personal attack.
Because they understood that, you know, and again, Jesus did this, but we miss as far as we realize. Jesus took some of the harshest prophetic statements. He does this elsewhere when he brings it and he uses some of Jeremiah's temple sermon in Jeremiah 7, and he uses it against the religious leadership in Jerusalem and the temple itself as well. When he talks about them being a den of robbers and thieves and so forth, that you, this is what you've done to my house. That's Jeremiah, what Jeremiah said, again, several hundred years before in the temple. So Jesus keeps on coming into the temple in Jerusalem and saying heavy prophetic things. But they didn't listen when Isaiah and Jeremiah said them. Jesus literally comes back and re-preaches Isaiah's or Jeremiah's sermons. And again, do they listen now? All the more they intend to kill him as well. And so it's interesting how it all comes full circle, where literally Isaiah, Jeremiah, and other prophets, Jesus comes and literally re-preaches their same words in the exact same places they were, with the exact same result that came before, which is they don't listen, which is why what will happen to Jerusalem once again? It'll be destroyed. Yes, ma'am.
And I suspect that they recognized that Isaiah, but thought to themselves, well, we're the righteous remnant. We are the new tenants that God has given Israel to, and we've got it figured out.
Yeah.
And we're doing a better job.
Yeah.
And that's part of why they're so angry.
Well, yeah. When he says that, you know, when he says the vineyard will be taken from you, all of a sudden begin to realize, you know, again, because we don't want to see ourselves as the bad guys in the stories. When he says, you know, then of course, now they read completely on the fly, could reinterpret the story of what he was really saying. You know, and so, you know, and what's, and again, what's God looking for? He's looking for a vineyard, a people who produces the fruit. And going forward, that's going to be the people of Jesus. It's going to be the New Testament church. And ethnic Jewish people are welcome to join in. But God is literally saying, physical Israel is not my vineyard anymore. We're giving it to new tenants. It's going to be different. Was there another hand I missed somewhere just now? All right, let's keep moving and try to get as far as we can for sake of time. All right, so what happens now, the rest of chapter 5, leading up to the call of Isaiah in chapter 6? Rest of chapter 5 is in some ways some of the harshest condemnation yet. More explicit sins and failures are mentioned. And in some ways, if you're a prophet reader, a regular prophet reader, you won't be surprised by Isaiah's list. And in some ways, what he's doing here is, you know, one way to look at it is the rest of the chapter, what he's doing is he is describing the bad fruit of the vineyard. You know, if he's just talking about the vineyard, that, you know, I came to check my vineyard and I got bad fruit out of it. What is that fruit? Well, instead of righteousness and, you know, and these other things he was looking for, this is what he got. And then really what this is a series of woes and consequences. And so, you know, verse 8, first woe. Woe to those who join house to house and add field to field until there is no more room. Stop right there. What are we talking about? We're talking about greed, but we're talking about a very specific form of greed that was explicitly condemned in the law. And in particular, was real estate. You'll notice he's talking about houses, he's talking about fields, he's talking about land. And so, talk about those who join house to house and field to field. You know, you got your own inheritance, you got your own allotment, but it's not enough. You want more. You're greedy, and so you know this neighbor's having financial trouble, so I'll buy his land. And this guy, you know, and so you build this. You have this, you know, land baron kind of thing. You know, build up these large Jewish ranches. No, but these large land holdings. Now, here's the thing: did God have a remedy for the buying up of land over time? Yes, he did. What was it?
The Jubilee.
Leviticus chapter 25, once every 50th year, in other words, once every generation, once every lifetime,
reset.
What was supposed to happen? Yeah, somebody just, it was a reset. A reset to what?
Whose land was originally belonging to?
Yes, because remember, who divided up the land when they went to the land? God did by lot in the days of Joshua. Again, that's why maybe you've heard me reference this before. That's the power of the Naboth story in 1 Kings 21 with Ahab. When Ahab offers him better land, and the text never denies that it's better land, Naboth says no, not because it wasn't good enough or because Naboth was greedy. Why does Naboth not want better land? Because he recognizes as a devout man that this land was literally God's providential choice for me and my family, and I am merely a steward. What does God say back in Leviticus, ironically, when he establishes the Jubilee? The land is mine. I created the dry land on the third day. It belongs to me, not you. You are merely tenants. And again, you know, we need to remind ourselves of that all the way through our lives, right? You are not, and even down to ourselves, especially as Christians, you are not your own. You have been bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body. But even if you didn't, you know, even as a Christian, if that wasn't your confession, God says, you think this stuff belongs to you? It doesn't. It was here before you got here. It's going to be here after you're gone. You don't take it with you.
Amen.
And so here's what they're doing. They're amassing sin. They're not keeping the law. But why would God, you know, stop and think about, why did God establish, what was the purpose of the Jubilee really anyways? Why do you reset every generation?
So you wouldn't get a conglomerate. So you wouldn't have one or a group of people or one family that winds up taking over everything and putting others underneath them.
Yeah, because in the ancient world, you know, by and large, you know, there was no middle class as we think of it today. There were a handful of elites, and every society will have elites. One of communism's great lies, you know, a society without which you're always going to have elites. But, and by the way, that's part of why we need to be very careful, sidebar, in the Bible to compare our economic system with theirs, and people want, you know, not comparing apples and apples. But here's what you got to understand. So in the ancient world, there is no capitalism, which means there is no middle class, which means that, you know, there aren't accountants by and large. I mean, you know, there'll be a few scribes in the king's court, but there aren't accountants, and there's no IT professionals, and there's no middle management, there's no human resources, and there are no dentists, and, you know, on down the list. And so outside of a handful of the elites in the king's court, what did everybody else do to survive? You farmed the land. And so if you're a person without land, what's your situation in the ancient world?
Destitute,
which is why all of a sudden slavery looks a little bit different, because now you understand why people would sell themselves into slavery, because not because it was a great life, but because it beat, what was the alternative?
Not even
starving in the ancient world, because if you didn't have land and you don't have connections in the king's court, how are you going to eat?
You're not.
And how are you going to feed your kids? You're not. And so what was God, because God being God, what does God, especially for his people, and their life in the land is meant to be an anticipation of eternity. God wants everybody to have a shot in their lifetime. Now, in the fallen world, will things happen? Will people sometimes get into debt? You know, you break your leg during harvest, you lose your crops, now you're, you know, yes, but should that mean my son's stuck being an indentured servant or worse the rest of his life because I lost my land and my generation? No. Well, that was in the Jubilee year. Even if I lost my land through time and chance, that happens to all, my son will get our family inheritance back.
Even if I was a slave.
ironically, even if I was a slave, because part of the Jubilee was the release of those who chose that over starving to death. But you know, again, because God, especially among his people, he wanted this image to the world of everybody's got a chance, of everybody gets a piece of the pie, of everybody gets to, you know, everybody gets to enjoy, you know, the great image of the prosperity of the Old Testament, every man under his vine and fig tree.
It leveled the
playing field. Because again, God realized in a fallen world, this is what will happen over time until you get a society that's so... But if you're not following the Jubilee, and by the way, there's no evidence in the Old Testament they ever followed the Jubilee, then what happens over the generations? You wind up with a lot of people who have no land, which means they're either literal or de facto slaves. You know, call it tenant farming, call it sharecropping, call it whatever. But they're either de facto slaves or you know, or actual slaves of these few who have joined house to house and field to field. Because here's the thing. If the Jubilee was going to be kept, who actually had to obey that law, the poor or the rich? Oh, yeah. Yeah, and we all know about human nature, that ain't going to happen. And so here comes Isaiah looking around saying, you guys, this has gotten out of control. Yes, sir.
Firstly, the king was responsible.
Well, and that's exactly right. Even go back to Judges, there was no king in Israel, but it was right in his own eyes. The idea that Deuteronomy anticipated was there would be a king, but it would not be a king like the nation. It would be finally summer, because the priests could teach, but the priests had no real enforcement power. The idea of the king in Deuteronomy was that's why he was to copy the law and keep it by him all his days. His job was to enforce justice. His job was to make sure the law was kept. He had enforcement power that the priests didn't. The priests could teach it, and the priests could obviously keep the temple clean and pure. But the priests were not empowered by the law to go out, you know, into the highways and byways in the fields. They weren't empowered to go up to Naphtali and sort out this mess. But a God-chosen king was. And by the way, that's why Absalom's complaint against, think about this, Absalom's complaint against David and his rebellion. My father does not deliver justice. And technically, Absalom was right by that point in David's story. David had begun to fall down on the job, and Absalom had a point. But that's what God was saying. Because what we can, if we don't have hierarchy, we have chaos. If we don't have hierarchy, and ultimately, God has a king. Now, again, the human kings fail, which is why God ultimately says, okay, I'll be the king. You know, not just in heaven, I'll become Emmanuel, I'll become a human king as well in Jesus of Nazareth. And God solves it both at the top and the bottom. And so God always intended to be king. His right hand was to be man, who runs creation under him, not as the law giver, but as the law enforcer. And what did God say to Adam? Be fruitful, multiply. What was the other command? Have dominion. We failed at that. So God says, okay, I'll do both the top and the bottom part myself. Jesus becomes human. Where is Jesus right now? At God's right hand, receiving, you know, receiving all rule. Not as just as God, but also as man. He's still human. Always happens. Yeah, Charles, you had a hand up back ways. My bad. My bad. All right, Mel's about to catch us. So, anyways, a bunch of these woes come crashing down. You know, there's the substance abuse. You know, verses 11 and 12. They're drunk and they're high. Let's see. One of the things that importantly, and perhaps one of the most famous verses in all of Isaiah, verse 20, another one of the woes. Well, actually, go back, verse 18. Woe to those who withdraw iniquity with cords of falsehood. A society in which deception and lying and manipulation are the way. You pull sin, but what's the agency? What's the means? What's your method of dragging your sin around? Falsehood. Except now we just call it marketing. No, I'm just kidding. No. Truly, statistics, actually. Statistics is the art of lying with numbers. But my favorite definition of statistics. But anyways, but part of what happens, besides in the practical atheism of verse 19, let him be quick, let him speed to his work that we may see it. You know, God's not going to do anything about it. The practical atheism is verse 20, one of the other major woes. Woe to those who call evil good and give complete moral inversion. That sound familiar? Are we there right now? You know, what happens to somebody who stands up and says, that's not a man, that's a woman, wearing a dress? What happens to you right now?
You lose your job.
You lose your job, yeah. And become unemployable in your career, in your field. Yes. You'll just lose your job. Your career is over. As you know, especially in certain fields, an educator, you know, certain other areas. You say that's not a woman, that's a man in a dress. You're done. That's where we're at. But one of the other things that happens in these, again, you know, the specific fruit of these societies, besides the fact that verse 18, deception, lying, manipulation becomes the tool by which we do so much. Moral inversion, verse 20, verse 21, and woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and shrewd in their own sight. Rule by the experts. Rule by the experts. We call them, well, again, there's a place for science, rightly understood. But then there's I am the science.
There's the pride that comes behind the eyes.
And there's the pride that, you know, the experts are always right. And that's very much where we're at. All right, we got to stop there. We will get to chapter 6 Wednesday, thank God willing.